Hello, gorgeous, gorgeous girls, and welcome back to another episode of Girlfriends. I'm Lindsay, and today I'm joined by Nix from Sounds Creepy Podcast. How are you, Nix?
I'm doing fine today, Lindsay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. I'm really excited to talk about The Silence of the Lambs, which is what we're covering today. It's just one of those films that you watch, and it's like I feel like everything's firing on all cylinders, and we've like been talking a lot about it off air already, and there's just like so much to sink your teeth into about it. What made you pick The Silence of the Lambs? Actually, I should actually reverse that. What is it about the kind of Hannibal series that you love so much? Because you've previously been on and talked about Hannibal, the follow-up to The Silence of the Lambs. So what is it about this series that you love so much?
Well, if we're referring to the Hannibal series, not the Mads Mikkelsen one on streaming or on TV, but the series itself, the books or the ones, the films, shall we say. What I love about them the most is that they really delve into some the depth of Anthony Hopkins or Hannibal Lecter's character. He's explained more as a person, as an individual. They identify him more as a person with problems than just a monster, which is such an easy thing to do, I think, for outsiders, people who do not like this kind of stuff or think that true crime is interesting or these kinds of books can be insightful in any way, shape, or form. That it is such a good story to sink your teeth into. And to learn more about the psychology behind why people do certain things, specifically, what could have happened in somebody's life to make them do extreme things? What could possibly have gone wrong and is not an excuse for bad behavior, but certainly gives one more insight to why people do things they do.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I find this film so interesting because as much as like Hannibal is like a bad guy in quotation marks, out of quotation marks, however you want to perceive him, like he's one of the few male characters that actually treats Clarice with any sort of respect throughout it. So as much as like he's the one in jail for like horrendous crimes, like all these other people who aren't like really look down their nose at Clarice throughout the whole thing, and it's interesting that this person that we're supposed to really despise is the only one that treats our girl with any sort of respect throughout the whole film. So I think that's interesting as well. It kind of turns that villain trope on its head a little bit.
It does. And I think one of the reasons that Hannibal treats Clarice so well to a certain degree, I mean, he does berate her. He plays with her in the beginning. She's a little toy and he's intrigued by the fact that she doesn't just squirm and run away. So he sees certain things in her and he wants to see where it can go. I mean, at this point, he's a man that's been locked up for quite some time. The proceedings of Red Dragon, proceedings of Red Dragon precede this. So, if you want to mo know more about why Hannibal is in jail when he meets Clarice, you should definitely give that a look or give that a read. But the reason he treats her so well, I think, to a degree, is because she reminds him a little bit of his sister. As we mentioned before the show started, is Hannibal had gone through a terrible thing as a child. You could, if you want to know more about that, you could read or watch Hannibal Rising. But he had gone through a terrible thing as a child and he'd lost his sister. And it has great impact on why he does the things he does. And that's, like I said earlier, it gives nuance to the fact that, yeah, he's a psycho killer. Yeah, there are some things that are terribly wrong with him. And I mean, I wouldn't trust to be with him in a room really alone. Let's be honest, it's great to have these ideas and fantasies, and truly they are just fantasies Because most people don't want to be in that situation where you're not sure about your life. Who wants to be skinned and eaten? No one that I specifically know, so I don't know how many people are out there. But she is attracted to him because he is dangerous. He's attracted to her because she's innocent. She's not jaded. She has a purity about her that he loves, an innocence, like I said. And I think it's never said that way, but I think it's truly because she reminds him of Misha. I think his sister's name is Misha. So yeah, that's definitely one of the reasons why he's kind to her. And in turn, she does tell him, listen, I'm gonna chase you. I won't just leave you to go. Like, there's nothing here. But yet she can't step away. He also doesn't allow her. I mean, it's a power game. It's definitely a cat and mouse thing. But if she wants to, she could stop with this whole thing. Go away. Don't be a part of the FBI anymore. But she wanted to do this. She also wanted to catch him as much as he wanted to catch her.
Yeah, there's like a intrigue on in both that goes both ways with them, that they aren't gonna like forever be caught in this like cat and mouse thing.
Yeah, definitely. And the other characters that come across his way are just little distractions, really. They, like, when we talk about Mason Verger and, like I said, Francis Dolarhyde, and where these people fit in, Freddie Lowndes, the Freddie Lowndes of the of Red Dragon, the film with Ralph Fiennes, is very different from the Freddie Lowndes that we get to meet in the series. Not just because, you know, it's a male and a female playing different parts. Philip Seymour Hoffman is fantastic. I'm not saying that the new actress is bad at all, but perhaps because it was Philip Seymour Hoffman, because it was a little grittier and not necessarily as sexy as the show is. You know, the show is pretty sleek and you know, made in a very different way than the films. But what was the point again? What were we saying about?
How the intrigue goes both ways with Clarice and Hannibal.
As I was saying, these other characters are really just pawns. They're pieces in the story that's really the Hannibal show. And he plays the board just the way he wants to, and he has power over people, perceived and unperceived. And the whole thing with Clarice is he truly is a little bit like a wolf that catches a rabbit but doesn't want to eat it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's get into this properly. So the IMDb plot for The Silence of the Lambs is a young FBI cadet must receive the help of an incarcerated and manipulative cannibal killer to help catch another serial killer, a madman who skins his victims. This film came out in 1991, stars Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, and Ted Levine. It was directed by Jonathan Demme, and he also worked on Rachel Getting Married and Philadelphia, and was written by Ted Talley, who and this was based on the books by Thomas Harris. So the film opens with Clarice doing her assault course at the Quantico Training Academy for FBI, which I kind of love because it kind of flips that trope of like helpless girl running through the woods on its head, and it's like actually she's there for a purpose, for a reason. And she gets called to Jack Crawford's office for her help interviewing Hannibal Lecter. I can't quite remember. I literally just watched this earlier today as well. It's as part of the case, isn't it? It's not like a, because they're like, oh, we're interviewing serial killers. So I can't remember if it's like for the Buffalo Bill case or it's just like as a part of that.
So basically, Jack Crawford wanted someone to speak to Hannibal, Specifically to try and catch Buffalo Bill. And Clarice had applied to be a special agent, who is a very promising officer. I think she was a police officer, but I'm not sure. But then she like specialized and she came to Quantico and she did the whole thing. And she was an exceptional student, if I'm not mistaken. Also, she didn't stand back for the physical stuff. That's Jonathan Demme, the director, specifically mentioned that in the director's, what do they call it? The director's
The director's cut.
the commentary. On the
Yeah.
director's commentary, he specifically said that he wanted to start with her going through this course and showing her prowess, you know, that she's strong and she's independent. She's not just this little helpless little girl. And specifically, you'll see there's a scene where she comes off of the course and she's all sweaty in like the gray sweatshirt, and she climbs into a lift, and there's a bunch of guys standing next to her, and they're all like 6 feet tall. And she's really, really small, but she stands her ground. She's not like, oh, excuse me, well, you know, she's there and she's present. And so you can immediately see like she's not taken aback. Her father also was a police officer. Hannibal talks to her quite a bit about it, and their relationship weirdly also revolves around her unresolved trauma about her father passing away when she was a little girl.
Yeah, for sure. And you kind of see that she wants to live up to the legacy that she's built up of her dad. Because like as a viewer, like we don't know her dad, but we know that she loved him and that she wants to make him proud by being his by like solving crimes and stuff as well.
Yeah,
I
you actually
love
do see. Sorry, yeah.
I was just gonna say, I love that scene where she walks into the elevator and it's just all these like super tall guys and she's just a petite woman. That's just the way she's built. And yeah, she just holds her own. Like I love that part.
Well, it also shows how hard she had to work to get there. You know, someone of her stature, a young woman, you know, in her position, now she's coming to, but there's constantly a standoff with men in this film. When they go to the funeral home, they go for the autopsy on, can't remember what her name is now, but the girl with the diamond shape cuts in her back.
Yeah.
And they go there, and she's trying to tell the guys, the officers there, that they can clear off now. You know, they have to do this autopsy and they should get out of the room. And she's trying to, you know, be like, hey guys, listen, we need to talk now. And then nobody's talking to her. No, everyone's ignoring her. And then she like raises her voice and she's like, guys, come on, we need to clear out now. And then they all look amongst each other, and then they look, I think, at Jack Crawford, and Jack Crawford's like, you know,
Yeah.
so it's definitely a situation where men are ruling her world. It was a very different time and a very different space for a woman to be on the force and to be a special agent as well. You have to remember, a lot of this stuff is grounded in the interviews and the people that Thomas Harris knew, the original author of the books. So it's grounded in real people, real cases, real things that happened. Thomas Harris himself said that during his research on one of the Hannibal Lecter books, he said that he had seen things, he was shown things by FBI agents concerning serial killers. And he says some of that stuff he really wishes he didn't actually see.
Yeah,
So yeah,
exactly.
no, definitely. They emphasize the fact that she's quote unquote a little girl in a big man's world.
Very much so. Yeah, it's like this world, like being a police officer, being an FBI agent, I'm sure like at some point I can't name them offhand, but there would have been rules around women not being allowed to participate in that, full stop. And I think there is a part as well later on in the film where they're like, let's take this conversation elsewhere because they deem the topic of sexual violence too fragile for too much for Clarice's fragile ears, apparently. When I was
Yeah,
watching it
she's
and
a little
thinking
girl.
like in non-women and like and gay men as well, like they'll have dealt with so much like misogyny and sexual violence that they know all too well about it. But then there's these straight guys who are like, let's take this out of the room so that the woman doesn't listen to it because it's too much for her. And it's just like, actually, well, unfortunately, all too aware of what you're talking about anyway. So yeah,
But
you
that's
don't
just
need
once
to do
again
that.
belittling her capacity, you know. This is, oh, she's just a woman, you know, she's sensitive and all these things. And once again, like I said, she, as far as I remember, was a very good student. And like I said, she had to be able to make the cut to be in the FBI.
Yeah, I think she was like in the top quarter or something, she says at one point. So yeah, very good student, knows her stuff, you know, handpicked by Jack Crawford to do this. So obviously he sees something in her that like she's obviously brilliant at this, to pick her as a student to do this and not one of his actual agents.
True, true. But Jack Crawford, just a little bit of backstory there. He's manipulating Therese throughout all of this. He is choosing her because she has high aspirations, because she is trying to make it to the top. It's
I think what kind of makes the film like all the more sinister is like a lot of the misogyny is a bit covert. Like, with the exception of Dr. Chilton, who we'll get onto in a minute, who's like just outwardly being like, you're a pretty girl and I want to take you out round the town, without even, you know, hearing anything that Clarice has to say. It's a lot of like changes in tone and, you know, dirty looks at Clarice, and like it's the way people look at her and the way in which they speak to her, and not the specific words themselves, that shows how other people view her before they actually get to know her, which is very, very interesting.
But also, I mean, hats off to all the actors and the screenwriting and the whole thing, that they were able to portray it so well that it's not overt, that it's a subtle thing that you have to be, you know, really listening out for. Even when she accidentally encounters Bill at his house, and she thought she was going somewhere else, and they were at the wrong house, blah, 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 blah. He makes like a crappy comment about the victim. He's like, oh yeah, was she a great big fat girl, you know? And so there's always sort of this underlying thing. There's also this thing of, oh, he needs overweight women so there's enough space for him to be inside of the physical suit that he is creating. So let us not forget, he's not just a guy parading around being a strangely attractive drag queen, weirdo serial killer, but there's also this thing of wanting to become female. I spoke quite a bit about this on our podcast. Our podcast has since unfortunately died online, but I still have the files with me. And I did an episode with my husband Sydney, where we spoke specifically about Silence of the Lambs and how he is changing, how Buffalo Bill is changing, and how change and ascension and rebirth are very much a big part of what makes Buffalo Bill who he is. It's a very big part of the story. And also in the film, in the book, they sort of mention something about trans people, him being transsexual or applying to be assigned gender reassignment surgery. And when she speaks to Hannibal, or when Hannibal speaks about Buffalo Bill, he specifically says that he believes he's transsexual, but he isn't. And then he says his pathology is 1,000 times more interesting, or I can't remember, or severe or intense, or I can't remember what he said, savage. So yeah, the way that Buffalo Bill refers to her, refers to women, of course you can expect that because he's the bad guy. But in all of this, really, Hannibal is the only one that kind of speaks respectfully, and yet he says some really off-color things to Clarice in the beginning to sort of, you know, push her buttons to see what she would do. Because as I said before, Hannibal falls in love with Clarice, but at first he was just playing with her. He was just seeing what new toy Jack Crawford brought in. You know, he's stuck in there. What's he gonna do? You can only listen to classical music for so much of your time and draw fantastical, beautiful, true to life imagery from memory. You know, charcoal paintings on the walls.
Exactly. Yeah, he sees something interesting in Clarice, like you say, you think it might be that she's quite similar to his younger sister, who died in very nefarious circumstances back in Lithuania. What do you think about the first meeting between Lecter and Clarice? Like, I love the cinematography and how like Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter is staring right through that camera, and you're very much put in Clarice's shoes, which I think again helps to make her like super relatable and like root-fordable, because you see everything really through Clarice's eyes, and Anthony Hopkins just like staring right through you through that camera. Like, it gives me chills, that performance.
It does. That's such a great scene. He's in the cell, and she's talking to him. It's when she was like, I think she got wet in the rain or something, when they were really having their first real, like, heart to heart, very vulnerable type of conversation for the first time. Sorry. He says that, sorry, just tell me again what you said previously.
Like Anthony Hopkins' performance, he really
Oh,
like stares and it gives you chills.
So what is really cool about those scenes is that you are basically the glass sort of disappears, and it is a head-on close-up shot, sometimes extreme close-up, of both characters. You're seeing her through his eyes, and he's seeing through her eyes, or you know, right? We're looking at her through his eyes, and she's looking back at him. And she is unflinching as well. You can see she's upset there, and she's small. She's in the bottom of the screen. You know, she's in the darkness, with just with the television to the back there flickering away. And I keep going off track because the cinematography is so damn good. But yeah, those moments are so strong. And it once again brings you to the fact that there is only a glass pane. There's only a glass pane between Hannibal and Clarice, and that she truly is, like I said, a little rabbit. She's a little hare crouching in the corner in the darkness. And here he is sitting, but he's actually sitting against the wall in that one, right? The lights are
Yeah.
off. And then he's talking about how Chilton is torturing him by putting the televangelist stuff on loud. Yeah, but anyway, this is the cinematography is so good in there as well. For some moments, when Hannibal is sitting there on the floor, you can see him, but you can't see all the detail in his face. He's sort of in the shadows, and the light that the television is casting is actually catching in his eyes. And he looks a little bit like an animal sitting in the shadows. This man is fantastic. You know, the shot where he is in the cage almost right at the end of the film, and he cuts Sergeant Pembrey's face off to wear himself, and he like kills the other guy, and he puts him up in this display, this Christ-like display. It's almost like a Renaissance art, you know? He's got the banners up and the dramatic lighting. You know, you got to give it to Hannibal. In literally a minute or two, he slices a man's head a face off. He puts another man on a cage and does a little bit of dramatic lighting and a little bit of drapery before he skedaddles out. That's very impressive, you know. I don't know the kind of clearly we get a better idea of the kind of sense of humor he has when he does stuff like that. And I mean, that's kind of what an artist would do, a truly crazy artist.
He is so much more intelligent than all the people who have caught him and contained him for the last 8 years, and that must like hurt him a bit that he
Frustrate him.
is
It bruises
so
his
much,
ego.
he's so much smarter than Dr. Chilton, yet he has to stay inside this cage under his orders. But it's Dr. Chilton's fault that he gets out, because he, like, Dr. Chilton is also so egotistical, he leaves the pen behind, and that is what gets him eventually.
Absolutely. Dr. Chilton, like you said earlier, he's a very interesting character. Anthony Heald, I think. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his surname, the actor. He played in some other thing. I can't remember where he was a teacher. It was on in the afternoons at some point on local television. But he's a great actor as well. Like I said, most of the people in this film, they're fantastic. They were not necessarily all very known, but like Ted Levine is amazing in this. And he stopped doing creepy characters because he could have done any serial killer I could really think of. After I've seen this performance, he's a fantastic actor, definitely underappreciated. But like he is great. Did you know that, you know who Roger Corman is? Okay, so
I've read
yes, so did you
about
know
this.
Roger Corman was actually in this film? He had a little cameo. He was some high up guy. Let me just see quickly here. Sorry, I was on my screen for a second. Oh yeah, here we go. He was. Oh, come on, for the life of you. Sorry, our internet's terrible here at the moment.
All right.
FBI Director Hayden Burke.
Oh, I missed
So
that.
I think he had one, two, three. He had three lines. I think early in the film. Yes, it's just before Hannibal gets transferred to Memphis. So Roger Corman is actually in this. But as we well know, Roger Corman and Jonathan Demme are connected. Jonathan Demme comes from the school of Roger Corman. Roger Corman's school of filmmaking. But like I said, the other thing is Anthony Hopkins, although we know him as such a fantastic actor today, and he's always been fantastic, he was in a film called Magic, where he plays a ventriloquist, and then the dummy becomes sort of his alter ego, and he starts doing really bad stuff, but as the dummy, as the marionette. So he actually got, I thought that that was the role that made him get this role because he was very intense. But then it turns out it was his role as the doctor in The Elephant Man, another great classic film, that put him on Jonathan Demme's radar. There were a bunch of people that were supposed to, I can't even remember the whole list. I read them in my episode, of the people that were cast. Or asked to be cast for Hannibal. There were a bunch of, including like Patrick Stewart and Hugh, no, yeah, Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman actually bought the rights to Silence of the Lambs,
I did read that,
and
yeah.
yeah, and he was going to play Hannibal, if I'm not mistaken. And he considered that for a hot minute until he also decided that he doesn't want to do any more violent roles himself. Because he had done quite a few of them, some really, really good roles. I saw there was a film that he did with, I don't know if it was Wyatt Earp. Was he in Wyatt Earp? Wyatt Earp. sorry, excuse me. So, anyway, there were a lot of really interesting people considered for this. And the reason that Jonathan Demme chose Clarice above everybody else, I don't want to lie, I think even Nicole Kidman was up for consideration. She got this, she really wanted this role. And he took her on because of the way she walked down the hallway toward him. And she was so determined that he was like, yeah, this woman looks like she knows what she wants. And I guess yeah, having a small stature, makes her be in a situation where she's constantly has to prove herself, even as a human being. You know, please listen to me, I'm over here, you know. Clearly not anymore, but I think earlier in her life, in her acting career, that was the case. And Jonathan Demme played into it so well. But I'm so happy he chose the people that he chose, because each and every one of them did their utmost in this film.
It's the kind of film like you really couldn't imagine anyone else doing it. Like it gave Anthony Hopkins like a much broader audience. I know he was like considering like stopping trying to break America and just stick with like British theater and like television productions. And
He's
it's
classically
like,
trained.
yeah, and like this film's the same age as me. Like I was born in 1991, so I have never lived in a world where Anthony Hopkins wasn't like this massive name. So to read that and be like, oh, like he hasn't always been this person was like insane. And then as well, like I was reading Michelle Pfeiffer was like one of the like top people considered for Clarice Starling. And
There you
like
go.
I don't like this is in no way like meant to be disparaging to Jodie Foster, but like I feel like Michelle Pfeiffer's too beautiful for it. There's something like quite normal looking about Jodie Foster, which makes her like a bit more relatable. Like I feel like you could see Jodie Foster at the supermarket as much as she
I
is this like
think
massive star. It's like it's not the same with Michelle Pfeiffer, and it would have taken
that's the
away from the
thing.
role.
Michelle Pfeiffer really turns heads. The character of Clarice is a woman. She's just a woman with a dream. She had difficult, poor upbringing, but she has the love of fairness and justice in her heart. Like I said, she truly is an innocent. She's almost naive to the world. She knows as much as she does know. She's almost resistant to the evils of the world. So she's quite a special person.
Yeah, 100%. So we've talked a lot about the kind of the first meeting. I'm quite curious about what you think about Clarice and Hannibal's final meeting at the, is it like Baltimore? In the cage, in the big room where he has all the classical music. He has since realized that she duped him before. And they have this like weird heart to heart where she reveals a bit of like childhood trauma to him. And it's like interesting, like Clarice doesn't have to open up to this man, but she does. Like, what do you think about that?
Well, I think we forget that Hannibal is a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Right? So he's well trained to elicit responses from people, to get into the nitty-gritty of who people are and what makes up who a person is. So I think that he sincerely started asking her about her life, and she sincerely started to tell him about it. And that situation where she duped him, so to speak, it was not intentional. She tells him, she's like, this, and they did this. This is not what I wanted. This is not what you and I discussed. And even after that whole exchange, the most important and most beautiful thing that happens there is that when he hands her the file, he calls her back as they're escorting her out, and she runs back and she grabs the file. And he just touches her finger. Just that moment of, I might be this dangerous monster, but I want to be close to you for some reason. It's a little bit Beauty and the Beast, actually. There's many, many allegories, many stories that you can compare here, where he's very much this dangerous, untamed thing that everybody thinks is a monster, but there are human traits in him that definitely, like I said, don't forgive terrible behavior, but certainly make him seem much more a three-dimensional character, as just saying, oh, he's, the slasher. He's the guy with the knife. He's the one that cooks people and eats them. People don't like to hear that. Once again, they don't like to think that these people are real individuals or could be real individuals with problems, because that makes them so much scarier. It's just easy to say they're monsters out on the prowl, thinking that they're perhaps someone that had a traumatic brain injury and is now completely, their personality has been completely changed. by no volition of their own. Now they start killing people or doing really, really outrageous, inhuman things. And people are like, oh, that person's possessed. Or and no, that person actually has something wrong inside of their brain. It's not their fault. They fell off a bike, or they got clonked in the head, or they played sports, or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of research now coming out about people who are murderers or serial killers or mass murderers. Not all of them, but many of them are actually coming out, and that there's proof that they have traumatic brain injuries, often undiagnosed. So yeah, this is just one of those situations where Hannibal is a cannibal. He kills people. He kills seemingly indiscriminately, because let's be honest, how do you know you're going to be a victim? He eats the rude. What is he considered to be rude? When you cut in front of him in a line, when where does the ultimate punish start and end? But he is this man who is starting to fall in love with this woman who also doesn't really have anyone. She is a fish out of water in her own environment, and as he is. It's his fault that he's there, but like you said, he's living under the thumb of Chilton and the state, and they're doing with him what they want. He has no recourse. So yeah, that he's wounded and he's caged, and him reaching out to her is, some people might say, and you could say, oh, it's a sense of self-preservation. He wants to get out. He wants to manipulate her. You could think all those things, but if you read the story, and you follow their story across the books, across the films, you will realize that they've never wanted to use her, but he always wanted her to be in his life, and he would stop at nothing. And like I said, that's where that manipulative part comes in. We don't like to think about that, but he's playing a game, obviously trying to be the winner and get what he wants. Hannibal is very persistent. And with that intelligence and that experience, he's always going to be playing in his favor.
Yeah, I think ultimately he will always act in a way that will help him the most. But I do also agree that there's love there for Clarice. Like, I wouldn't say it's romantic love. I don't know if he's really capable of romantic love, but like
It's a
platonic,
facsimile thereof.
even like paternal, like platonic. I
It's
don't know about
weird. Listen,
romantic, but yeah.
it doesn't, no, there is romantic, but you have to remember that it's strange, it's convoluted, it's complicated, it's certainly
Yeah.
not a straightforward thing. And as you well know, people fall in love because of very strange reasons, very strange things keep people together. And you don't know if you know the whole story, if you watch the end of Hannibal, and do you know about the alternate ending?
No.
Okay, so the film, I think it's 2001, Hannibal. In the film, the ending of the film, there are two versions. There's the book version, and then there's the film version. Luckily, Thomas Harris actually wrote both. He wrote obviously the book, and he helped rewrite the ending of Hannibal. I wasn't Jonathan Demme, very good actor as well. Anyway, he helped rewrite that for the screenplay. So what we see in the end of Hannibal the film is that he brought Clarice back after her getting injured, and he kept her alive, and he medicated her. She came back. They did the whole thing with Paul. So Paul Krendler, and afterwards they have this situation in the kitchen, which is just a fantastic, from a story point of view, from a storytelling point of view, where he captures her hair in the freezer, and like their hands are cuffed together, and then he chops off his arm, but for a moment it looks like he might actually be chopping off her arm or her hand to get free, remember? And then there's a moment where you don't hear the sirens, you don't see anything, but the music, the classical music is there, the Goldberg variations. And then she pulls a face like she's in agony, like she's pulling away. But we, so like I said, the insinuation is that he is harming her, but he actually cuts his own arm off. We see him later, he escapes. We see him on the plane with the little kid. Okay, that's not the original ending. The original ending from the book is he escapes with Clarice, the whole thing happens, but then he gets away with her. He doesn't get he doesn't go on the lam again himself. He takes her away and he sort of keeps her drugged to a certain degree. He keeps her sort of just a little bit not quite sober, not quite there, because he is a shrink. He has access to medications. In any case, so he keeps her sort of drugged for a while, and the theory goes that she started loving him. He kept her around for long enough that she could no longer help herself, because she said to him in the film ending, he says to her, "If I said stop, just stop chasing me, stop trying to catch me, would you?" And she's like, "Never in a million years." And then he's like, okay, that's my girl. Such a great situation, such a great scene. But yeah, like I said, most of that didn't happen. He got away with her. I think they went to Florence. And Barney, the guy who had was looking after him in
Yes.
the sanatorium, it's a criminally insane institution for the criminally insane. Barney actually saw them once at the opera or some kind of play, and he quickly backed away and didn't want to be seen. But it turns out Hannibal and Clarice were living together, were in love, were going out to the opera together somewhere in Europe a couple of years later.
Wow. I'm not, like, I honestly, and like the films are obviously like a bit different from the book, but I never would have got that from this film. So that's really interesting.
It's actually, like I said, I don't want to say, idealization is terrible in the day that we
Yeah.
live in, and all that stuff, but it could also just be a Beauty and the Beast situation. There's nothing wrong with feeling the loss and being moved by forces outside of ourselves and loving people that we are not supposed to love, people that are bad for us. I'm not saying any of that stuff's good, but that's certainly a lot of people's story. That's valid. Not everybody's in love with a serial killer, but people have many, many people have had tumultuous relationships that are complicated and weird and beyond description.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, we don't always love people who are good for us, unfortunately, but yeah, it does happen.
So he's the epitome. He's like the most high point of what a strange man could be. They're like the poster child for how strange a relationship really could be. And I know you said you're not sure if there's any romantic love there, but there has to be. Why would he keep coming back? Why would she keep coming back? Like I said, she could just leave. She could decide, this is too weird, I'm going to leave the FBI. But no, she had something to prove. And she didn't care if Hannibal was in the way because she felt indomitable. She felt like she could bring him down. And she felt that she was the best person for it because she wouldn't hurt him. Now, why would she care about? Why would she care about hurting him? She said, if you come with me, I'll make sure, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, that's not going to go down like that. And you can feel that she's devastated by the fact that that's the truth.
Yeah.
But there's nothing that she can do for him because she feels like she's gotten to know him, and she doesn't feel she pretends like she's not interested in him. She pretends like there can't be anything romantic. But yet, if you look in the film Hannibal, she's reading every letter he writes to her. She's analyzing them. Yeah, because she's an investigator and she needs more clues. But she's spending all this time listening to the tapes that Barney made or that Dr. Chilton made. About things that Hannibal says about her. Why would she care about that? That's got nothing to do with the case. It's got nothing to do with catching Hannibal and everything to do with what Hannibal has to say and how he feels about Clarice.
Yeah, the infatuation is certainly like a two-way thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's sad and beautiful to see because most people don't love with that kind of intensity. You know, the candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long. But we don't really have stories like that where crazy people are doing crazy things. I mean, you can't even say crazy, let's just say wild. But I do believe that he had some mental health issues. You know, he had PTSD. He had PTSD himself. He saw something terrible happen, and that turned him into a kind of person that perhaps to some degree, he didn't feel like he had a lot of control over it. He had these emotions. Clearly, he also has violent outbursts because when we see him in Hannibal, the film, we see him hacking those guys apart. The guys that came for him, the Sardinians, he just stabs them. He comes around a corner, makes a face, and then slashes the guy's throat like a real maniac. You know, he's just really, really damaged, okay? Really damaged.
I mean, even early on in this film, like he, well, we're never told exactly how it goes down, but we just know that he is whispering something to Miggs, and then Miggs ends up choking on his own tongue,
Oh, yeah.
after he is disrespectful to Clarice, and that's just after their first meeting. So very early on, like Lecter makes it clear that he, I don't know, he wants to protect her, or he wants to, like, it's a gesture, isn't it, to Clarice? Like, I've done this for you.
Maybe, but I also think he doesn't want anything bad to reflect on him. He wants her to think that he's in charge of this area. It's his home, so to speak. And for her to be insulted in his house means that he doesn't have control.
Yeah,
And
it's the
more
only
than just trying to
time.
stand up for her, I think it's also kind of like, because he says rudeness is unspeakably evil to me, or it's unspeakably ugly to me. So, yes, it is about him attacking her, but it is also just about the fact that somebody that's quote unquote under his roof is being terribly, terribly rude to another person that Hannibal doesn't deem to be somebody who should be messed with.
It's like it's the only time in this film anyway that he raises his voice is when that happens. So yeah, it does kind of unearth something in him, which makes sense if like rudeness is evil to him.
Yeah, and like he said, you know, he has those fanatical moments where, like I mentioned, he has moments of violent outburst. So yeah, you can expect that some of his reactions and some of his interactions would be quite severe.
Absolutely. And we see this as well after Clarice leaves the Baltimore cell that they've kind of created for him in the City Hall building. And as soon as she's dragged out, he requests a second dinner of lamb, and he uses Chilton's mistake against these two police officers. And like you say, one of them is hung up in a very, dramatic display. Another one has their face bitten and is later like has their face skinned or something, and he wears it. And it's all very like ostentatious. It's just it's a big show, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and he is the ringmaster. Like I said, he's somebody very intelligent, loves to travel, loves art. He, apart from being a certified serial killer, he is a man that loves to live. You know, he likes to indulge in the things in life and the finer things. And if you can't do that, you're dead. And he will do whatever it takes, you know, to bring that sort of pizzazz back into his life. He's an animal playing with his prey, a spider or a cat, if you will. And he's just bathing people around. He's changing the situation to suit him. And why go out in a boring hail of bullets when you can have this mastermind plan that nobody saw coming and that is actually almost too easy off if you think about it. It's just him using his brain going, hey man, they're not going to expect this. Let's do it. Also, little tidbit, the guy coming up the stairs, the policeman with the mustache, who's right in front, dark-haired guy. As they're coming up the stairs, he's sort of leading them, the squad leader. That is Chris, is it Chris Isaacs? He was a singer quite some time ago. He had a song called Wicked Game. And he, yes, and he had a song called Blue Hotel. I'm sure he had many others, but he was quite famous in the late 80s, I'd say. And this was also almost a little cameo for him. Like he was already an established singer by this point, and he did this film, and I think most people didn't know it was him. Because he has this whole 50s greaser Elvis-like look to him. That was like his style. And now he's this, police officer all in blues with this mustache and then like his gun, So that was very cool as well.
So what kind of brings Clarice and Hannibal Lecter together is Clarice wanting to find out more about Buffalo Bill. We've kind of touched on him a bit, but I want to kind of dig in a little bit more about him as the kind of main villain. Would you call him a villain in the film? But it's like his killings that are like the catalyst for the film, really. So like what do we think about Buffalo Bill as a villain in this, his kind of portrayal in this?
Well, it's a little bit complicated because, people's opinions haven't changed. Their opinions have always been the same. People's rights are now way to the forefront. People are fighting for their rights, which is the most beautiful thing. When this film came out and when this film was devised, we did not know as much about the trans community as we do today. And for some people in the trans community, this film bothers them. The portrayal bothers them because despite Hannibal saying that James Gunn, that's his name, Buffalo Bill, despite him saying that Buffalo Bill is not really a true transsexual, he's a maniac that wants to turn into a woman. He doesn't really want to be a woman and live a woman's life. He feels that if he has the power of a woman, if he becomes this other creature, he will find solace. He will find happiness. It will transform him. That's why, like I said, transformation is such a big part of this whole story, this whole film. The moth that they find in the back of the first victim's throat. And the moth that we all now know so very well, the Death's Head moth, also comes back to life, death, rebirth. The whole thing really connects so well. But the thing with Bill is that, what did you ask me about Bill?
Like
So much to tell you about
just like what do you think about him as like the villain? Like what do you think about his character?
So yeah, it's difficult in this one because Bill and Hannibal both are the bad guys, so to speak. But Bill is the active killer. He is the subject of this film. Every movie or every book of Hannibal that involves Hannibal sort of has a monster of the week, right? So it's in this one, it's James Gunn. In Red Dragon, it's Francis Dolarhyde. So in this what I think about, I keep getting sidetracked. I'm sorry, just bring it back. You said, what is it about Buffalo Bill?
Yeah,
What
like
do we
what?
think of him? What would you think of him as in general? Okay, so I do think that Buffalo Bill, also James Gunn, has had a very traumatic upbringing. If you read a little bit about the character and you follow the story, you'll see that he also comes from a bad background, that he was abandoned. He supposedly killed his grandparents when he was young, which reflects on or it mirrors Edmund Kemper. Ed Kemper killed his grandparents when he was something like 12 or something. I can't remember. So
Yeah.
the great thing about the character Jane Gum is that he is an amalgamation of maybe I think it's five or six different serial killers that Thomas Harris has mentioned specifically. And they are most of them are famous, but one or two of them are not as famous. And I can't recall all of them now, but if you go and you have a look, like the thing about the girl in the pit, I can't remember this guy's name, but that was a real serial killer. He kept a woman in like this, it's not even a basement, it's a hole that he dug in the floor of his home. And it was like a shallow pit, and they had to live under the floorboards. So I'm not going to go into any of that real world traumatic stuff, but that's some real stuff being put together. That's why he's such a complex character, also, is because he's not just one guy. He's once again this personification of an evil man, just like Hannibal is supposed to be the personification of a psychopath. Right? So the interesting thing about him is, like I said, he's this big amalgamation of all the serial killers. And he also is a complex individual with many problems and terrible, terrible ways of outing their frustrations. But once again, I think these are people who don't know what's quote unquote wrong with them, what is causing their behavior, why they're acting like this. And these are people that seemingly are unhinged and just have no guard up, or they can't stop themselves from doing the things they do. For Buffalo Bill specifically, he had a goal and he didn't really care how he had to go about it. He wanted this. He wanted this transformation. And he didn't even really indulge in killing these women or torturing them, really. You see that he's clearly unwell when he's standing next to the pit and he's screaming while she's screaming, but he doesn't really seem to enjoy torturing them. He tells her to put the lotion on the skin and unless it gets the hose again. He's not touching them. He is not communicating with them. He wants to keep himself as far away from it as possible. So I think he's kind of treating her like cattle. Like leather. And that's a
Because
way to get away from the fact that he's doing this to a human being. He doesn't want to think about the fact that he's doing this to a human being. He doesn't take pleasure in this.
when Catherine's pleading in the hall, like he can't handle it. He's like, he even stops with his like repetitive things. Like, just put the fucking lotion in the basket. Like, he just can't cope with it. He wants out of here as soon as possible because
Absolutely.
he can't cope with it.
Yeah, I think he is as unsettled by it as she is to a certain degree. But because he has this notion in his mind that he has to do this, the juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak. The lotion is worth it. But yeah, that is just he had this terrible. You know, the first thing that happened to him is he was misnamed and nobody cared to change it. It was a clerical error. So he started life like that. His mother, he was also in and out of foster care as a young child. His mother was a failing actress. Very few people know this, that he used to watch his mother's tapes over and over again. That's why he has the well, it's a cellar, I guess. I don't know if that's also part of the basement, right? Like there's the camera and there's like a TV and there's all sort of. And that was his mother's stuff, his mother's clothing. He learned to sew through his mother, making dressmaking and stuff for herself as an actress of stage and screen. Something like she didn't, she was big on stage or did relatively well for herself, but her on-screen acting career was a failure. So he would watch her old movies and things like that, but ultimately, like she was an alcoholic and she died. I can't remember what exactly the situation is, but that was the beginning of his life, living with this mother who is an alcoholic, who had severe depression and very other bad issues. So he grew up in that, and then I think I don't want to lie, I think he went to the military, and then things just got worse and worse and worse for him because he's homosexual. He's definitely homosexual. because he had relationships. Now, we don't know if he actually had a relationship with the first victim. Why can't I not remember her? Frederica
Frederica
Bimmel.
Gemmell. Oh, Bimmel, yeah,
He
not
Bimmel,
Gemmell.
Bimmel, yeah. He supposedly had a relationship with her, and he took all these pictures of her in her underwear. But that had nothing to do with her being naked. That had everything to do with her having really supple skin. Okay, so but it's quoted as saying he had a relationship with her, but then he also had a relationship with is it Louis Fiend? Who you remember the guy whose head is in the jar?
Is it Raspail?
Raspail, Benjamin Raspail.
Yes, that's
So
it.
his former lover is also Buffalo Bill's former lover. Buffalo Bill had a relationship with a Swedish or Norwegian sailor. I don't want to joke. And then this guy went away and had this other relationship with Louis with Benjamin Raspail. And Benjamin Raspail died for it, well, paid for it with his life. He skinned him and he didn't just pickle his head, he also made an apron from his skin. And that's how the whole skinning thing started. He started by making himself a little apron out of his ex-lover's lover. So he's a bit all over the place. But yeah, he clearly has something inside of himself. He seeks redemption. He like I said, that's one of the reasons why the Christ-like figure and the Renaissance type art is so very strong in this, the imagery, that most people don't even see it, which is interesting. They don't see the death and rebirth part of it, but the whole story, all of it, through also the death of these girls, he will be reborn. The song Goodbye Horses, if you listen to the lyrics and you read what the author, what the writer of the lyrics intended and who he was and the things that he read and what he was inspired by, that song makes so much sense. And that song is an accident. They didn't intend to use Goodbye Horses. They wanted to use another song, but Ted Levine convinced Jonathan Demme that they should use this other song. No. Jonathan Demme convinced him because Jonathan Demme was in a cab ride with the woman who made the song, like the singer. She didn't write it, she sang it. And he heard her song or he asked her to hear some of her music because she mentioned that she was an artist. And then he got her to do a version for the film. But her own story is also so sad and tragic. I can't right now remember her name. But she passed away like a year or two ago. She was in a band called Lazarus, Q Lazarus, right? And she was in this band. I think they were called the Revival or the something like that. Point being, also having death and revival and like rebirth, Lazarus coming back from the dead. This song was not intended for this film, and yet this whole thing slots in so well together. The song Goodbye Horses, it's a reference to the earthly troubles, the things that tie you to this plane of existence. And flying over your horses is overcoming your troubles, overcoming the physical world. Sorry, it's a bit much, but it all just actually slots in so beautifully. So this film truly is a treasure if you go and you uncover what is it about, what inspired it, where is Thomas Harris coming from, where is Jonathan Demme coming from, Anthony Hopkins's portrayal, you know, who is he, who is Jodie Foster, where did they come from, how did they all slot into the thing? Same thing with Ted Levine. Ted Levine is so underappreciated, and he didn't even get top billing on this film. Did you know that? He is one of the main characters, possibly as important as Hannibal. He wasn't even mentioned on the poster.
Yeah, I noticed that as well, which is so weird considering he's the antagonist, but
There's nothing. They mention Scott, what's his name? The guy
Scott
that played
Glenn.
Scott Glenn, which, I mean, to be fair, Scott Glenn had done quite a bit of work by that time. But I mean, let's be honest, who stole the show? Scott Glenn or Ted Levine?
Exactly. Everyone remembers Buffalo Bill from this movie, don't they?
So I couldn't even retroactively just go, okay, maybe we should put his name on the poster. Yeah.
You've made like so many good points there. I think it's when people take issue with Buffalo Bill being transgender in this film, I think there is something like you have to remember. This was the 90s. If you were transgender, you had to, well, certainly in the UK anyway, you had to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria. So I don't know if Buffalo Bill's transgender or not. That's not up to me to make that decision. But if they'd gone to try and get gender reassignment surgery and been turned down for that because someone else told them that you're not trans
Several
enough, then
times.
that is gonna, that's gonna be very upsetting. And if you already have other issues going on that would preclude you to towards violence, then you know what? Probably set me off, honestly. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
Sometimes I just, like when you hear his backstory and how awful it is, you sometimes hear these stories and I'm just like, well, I probably would have killed folk as well if that happened to me because that sounds fucking terrible.
Yeah, I don't know. I look at these people, and once again, you know, they're not idols.
No.
They're tales of caution. Get help. I think one of the big problems with especially this generation, now we're talking about Hannibal and Buffalo Bill's generation, of that was not fashionable to seek help, emotional or mental health assistance, nor was it really readily available. Especially as a man, boys don't cry.
Yeah.
And a bunch, and as we now know, especially, I mean, in America, we know there's a big problem, but the whole of the world, we have a bunch of veterans that went and fought and were forced to do things. I mean, I live in a country that has conscription. When my grandfather and my father and my uncles were young men, they had to go and fight in a war, be in an active duty. So with a thing like with Buffalo Bill, those situations arise where you've got this whole thing in the army about being gay. Now he tries to seek help, was turned down multiple times, clearly because there was something else. This was not what it was about. It wasn't about being called a woman. It was about becoming a woman. And this was the only way that he thought he could achieve it without the surgery.
Yeah.
And we don't even really know if he wanted to have any kind of physical surgery. He just wanted reassignment, but they don't really say what kind of reassignment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like I said, it's far from us to make any claims about anything. But like I said, there are definitely some people that feel like this portrayal is not very positive. But again, the writer, the actors, the director, those people, everyone involved, were not as aware of
Yeah.
trans people as we are today. They were not as aware of the fights. They were not as aware of all of this stuff. But I also know some trans people that I know in my personal life that have said that this film was important to them. And unfortunately, it was a bad portrayal, but it was the first time that they saw
Yeah.
somebody that was supposedly trans in film.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't a thing. If you want to know a little bit more about this, I do suggest that you watch a documentary. I don't know if it's on anymore. It was on Netflix called Disclosure.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting about trans portrayal in film and television. So yeah, if you want to know, anybody wants to know a little bit more about that, but yeah, definitely a very interesting character, interesting pathology, as kind of Lecter points out, and his interaction with Clarice at the end is almost also sweet. He apart from the fact that he makes a flub, but he's socially awkward about her being a big fat girl. He doesn't really want to come across as some kind of weirdo. He tries to be slick, but he's so touched that he doesn't know that he's coming across immediately as a suspicious person. But also right in the end, the standoff with Clarice was almost heroic. I don't know how else to put it. He knew he was going to go down, and he didn't want to go down just like that. But I mean, let's be honest, if Clarice didn't get him, I don't think he would have stopped.
Absolutely not. I love the kind of final showdown between them where it's in the dark with the night vision goggles, like it adds like a bit of drama, and
Yeah.
Clarice, she looks terrified. You would be. You're in the dark with someone who also has a gun. You
Well,
don't
dude,
know
it's
that they
the
have
most
that.
terrifying part of the whole film when people say, oh, well, it's not a horror film. And technically, it's not, it's a thriller. But that is so creepy. It is so creepy. Like I said, when I was a kid and I saw that dead lady in the bathtub, I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on here, but I don't want to be here anymore.
It's all
Yeah, and
the
it's an amazing
times.
showdown.
Yeah. It's all the times he's like super close to her, and you just see the hand reach out to her, and she has no idea whatsoever.
So why is he not attacking her? Cat and mouse.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cat and mouse in this. It's crazy. He comes right up to her and he reaches out, but he doesn't do it because he wants to chase her. Also, I think any kind of interaction. Hannibal was secluded. Buffalo Bill is secluded. These are not people that are allowed in society. And Clarice, even if it's for a bad reason, actually give them some interaction.
Yeah, because he's like way out in the sticks. Like Hannibal is like forcibly secluded, but James Gunn is like socially secluded.
Yeah, it's not just about where he lives, it's the fact that he can't make friends with people because he's a tiny bag of nuts.
Yeah.
Like he's as mad as a hatter. So of course the interactions that he has with people will be strange. They will be jilted or stilted, and of course that's one of the reasons why some of these people have so many problems is because they feel excluded from society because there is no one for them. They live this life where they feel that there's no meaning. They don't know how to create their own, and when left to their own devices, people who truly have problems can cause real problems.
I think, yeah, that's all very true because, you hear these stories about all these terrible things that happen to somebody and that then leads them on to go on to do terrible things. And it's like, where was the intervention at the point where these things started to happen? Or sometimes you can even predict sometimes that these things might happen if there's something like the parents have a violent history. It's like, well, maybe we shouldn't have left them with a child. Okay, like maybe that child should have been removed at some point,
Yeah,
but
it's the same thing. Like I said, with him, like possibly being in the military. I can't remember word for word. I can't remember the whole story. But the point being that a lot of those men fell through the cracks.
yeah.
They didn't get the kind of help they needed. Not like I said, not only was it not socially acceptable to feel anything, those kinds of services were not available. So when these people had these problems, displayed these problems from a young age, perhaps, either there was no parental supervision, Hannibal didn't have parents, James Gunn didn't have a mom for very long, and he killed his own grandparents. So there's nobody to say, hey man, things are not going well. Maybe you should stop killing little animals. Like, let's
Yeah.
start with that, you know? So there's no intervention. Hannibal actually did really, really well. He educated himself. He pushed through the whole thing. He didn't adjust so well, clearly, but he got like a at a at a to a very high station in life, whereas James Gunn never became anybody. And that might even be one of the reasons why he wanted to change, is because he wanted to matter.
Yeah, if he had a mum that was like really set on becoming a star, that will have imprinted on
And
him.
that's an again also a problem of the previous generation not getting the help and the medication that they need, falling into depression and alcohol, and you have a small child that's around you the whole time. You can't look after yourself, never mind look after them.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like as well, Buffalo Bill's death also kind of leans into the whole religious aspect of it as well. Like, what's done in the dark will come to the light, and it's like Clarice shoots through the
The light
window,
actually comes, yes,
and
and it
it,
shines on him,
yeah.
yes, like the fallen Christ. I tell you, if you look for it, and I mean, I didn't read this anywhere, and I'm not very religious myself, but I know quite a bit about religion. I know quite about art, and I could see it. Like once I started watching this movie and really trying to understand what it was about, not just flinching at the weird bits, this whole thing came out, and I think that Thomas Harris is a very underappreciated writer. He has given us something truly beautiful here, and I'm also very happy with Mads doing his thing. He's a fantastic actor. I don't know if I wanted Mads to be opposite Jodie Foster necessarily. I'm very happy that we got Anthony Hopkins to do that for us for such a long time. But Mads is definitely something.
Yeah.
He's attractive and he's dangerous and he's weird and cool in a sort of European way. I haven't watched everything yet, and I haven't seen like the Clarice series. There's a Clarice series now as well, which I
Yeah.
never got a hold of. Is it good?
I haven't seen it, but I think it's only like very, very, very recently come out.
Something like last year, and it's not everywhere. It's not easy to stream. I think it's something
No.
like HBO Max or something. I'm not sure. But yeah, I think Mads is great. And I think he's got a great energy about him. But he is strange, and that's the thing that makes Hannibal interesting, is that he is strange.
Yes.
I like strange things. I mean, that's
Yeah.
maybe just me. The people who get put off by that's not for them. The people who like to see what's under the log, what's hiding under the leaf litter, those are the people who are intrigued by these stories. But ultimately, they are not people get pass judgment on others because they like true crime, because they find the stories to be interesting. And I make the argument that this is no different than a play, or like, how is this? It's slightly different than Midsummer Night's Tale, but there's some murder, there's some mystery.
So the film finishes up with Clarice at her graduation party, and she gets a phone call from Hannibal Lecter. The often misquoted, well, Clarice, as people always say, hello, Clarice. He never says that in the film. He says, well, Clarice, when he answers the phone. And it turns out he's in the Bahamas. And I love this final scene because I just know this horrible cunt is just going to get what's coming to him.
Chilton, oh yes, it's
Yes.
so beautiful and it's so poetic. It's also kind of light and airy, and he's got like his Panama hat on, his little suit, and it looks like he's like just having a little drinky poo, you know. Just watching this man, he's like, oh, I'm having an old friend for dinner. And
Yes.
Chilton's just like, but you have to remember, Chilton got like a promotion or something because of the whole Hannibal thing, because he handled the Hannibal thing. And he thought he got away with it too, that stinky, stinky man. But yeah, Hannibal is on his, and once again, it just shows us the humor of Hannibal. He cracks that little joke about going to kill Chilton, which he ultimately did.
Yeah.
And but it's all sort of a little bit lighthearted and ta-ta, H, you know?
Yeah,
See
I
you
love
again.
that.
We'll
I
meet
love.
for drinks again sometime. When we're in Florence, we should definitely go for coffee.
I love the like the nonchalance of it. I love the double entendre of him having an old friend for dinner. And you know what he means, but he could be meaning like the actual like non-sinister version of
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah,
that.
Chilton, he'd love to sit down for a meal with Chilton, I'm pretty sure.
Oh my God,
Chilton as
yeah.
the meal. Sorry, I misspoke.
So yeah, that's the Silence of the Lambs. There's so
Before
much,
you go on,
yeah.
hold on. Did you know that at the graduation scene, She has a little scar on her cheek. I don't know if you can see.
Yes.
That's gunpowder residue from firing her firearm in the enclosed area in his basement. And in the book, it's actually quite highlighted because they look like little freckles on her cheek. And then when you get to the next book, which is Hannibal, I think he actually comments on it. He's like, I saw you on the news and I saw your little, I think he refers to it as a birthmark or something like that. I can't remember. But that specific, you can actually see her. She has like a little, she's roughed up on the cheek while she gets the award. And it's kind of weird how they didn't really lean into that because I thought it was such a cute thing, him re referencing that, sort of like she got her wings, you know, she's qualified now that she's seen some real action. But yeah, that's the movie, and it's a fantastic film. And please, 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 whoever you speak to, everyone out there, don't ask for a remake. If you hear that they're busy with a
God.
remake, storm them like you would storm Area 51. We can't have this. We do not need a remake of Silence of the Lambs. Please, dear God, stop.
It's one of
Whoever's thinking
those
about it, just stop.
it's one of those films where it's like absolutely everybody from cast to crew was firing on all cylinders throughout the entire production. Like, there is no need for an update on this. That, like,
And yet,
it's
look at like don't even get me started on the live action adaptations of some films, Disney films, obviously.
Oh, they're so
So
bad,
I
aren't
am a
they?
massive, massive Lion King fan. This was the first movie I saw in cinema. Yes, to some I'm a baby, to some I'm an old lady. But it was the first movie I ever saw in cinema as a kid. And I was obsessed with this film. My parents bought it for me on VHS when it came out on VHS. And I watched it religiously. Like some people talk about how their kids into like Little Shark or fuck it, what's it called? Baby Shark or Dora the Explorer or Pippa the Pig. That was my Pippa the Pig. That was my Teletubbies. I would watch it over and over and over again. And now it makes more sense to me because now I know I have OCD and I've had it basically my whole life. But that was sort of soothing to me to watch this movie over and over again. I knew every single word, I knew every lyric, I knew every actor and everything about this film. And then Jon Favreau decides that what he's going to do is he is just going to devastate my childhood. I never thought that I could feel this way about a film. Like, oh, it doesn't take away from the original. Just because there's a new one doesn't take away from the original. And yet I was so astounded by how terrible it is. I mean, like, these films are good and they've got something valid. You know, it's beautiful, it's new technology. But we didn't have to do it again. Zazu was great when he was Anthony Hopkins, Rowan Atkinson. He didn't have to be John Oliver. Not that John Oliver has any problems. I like him, I think he's hilarious. But we didn't have to do that. Just didn't have to do that. So yeah, I feel the same way about this. Please, dear God, don't remake it. Aladdin 2. Why did we remake Aladdin? We could never redo what Robin Williams did for us.
And it's
That could
longer by
never be
like.
recaptured.
It's like an extra hour or something long as well.
Is
It's just
it?
like, it's like quite significantly longer. And I'm just like, what the hell have you put in the extra?
No, it was like I said, I'm pretty sure that everybody cast and crew gave their best with these remakes, but it kind of is lightning in a bottle. Okay, you're not going to, they think what they're going to do is they're going to get the new generation onto it. Yeah, they are, but not for the right reasons.
I think we're like totally in tangent central now, but I think it's kind of insulting to the kids up and coming that they think that they won't be able to get into the 2D animation. And it's just like, I actually have a bit of faith in the product that you
A
put out.
money
And
grab. No,
yeah,
that's
it's a
not it at
money grab as
all.
well.
It's a money grab. They just want to sell more IP. That's all because the people that watched, you know, 1994's The Lion King, are not spending a lot of money on it right now, but their parents are going to be so hyped to see the movie because they saw it. And now the little kids are like, oh, I want to go see Lion King. Mom and pops are like, oh, yes, let's do it. It's amazing. And they make so much money in the ticket office. And here we are. But I mean, John Favreau is fantastic. Like The Mandalorian. Have you watched The Mandalorian?
Not the biggest Star Wars person, so I haven't
And you don't
watched
have
it.
to be.
Oh,
That's the
okay.
best part. So the nice thing about The Mandalorian is you don't really have to know anything about Star Wars to enjoy it, because how it does touch on some things later on, but it's a story in its own.
Oh, maybe I should
Very,
watch it
very good.
then.
Great acting by Pedro Pascal.
Love Daddy
Yeah.
Pascal.
Well, there we go. Yeah, honestly, highly recommended.
So back to the Silence of the Lambs. There's absolutely like tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of trivia about this. When I watched this last week, like I read through it all. I think it took me like an hour because there's so much. So I'll kind of stick to like the Oscar trivia that I have. So this is one of three films to win the Big Five. So the other two films are It Happened One Night in 1934. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And the Big Five are Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and one of the best writing. For in this case, it was Best Adapted Screenplay.
Amazing.
What's also really cool about this film is if you're like into Oscars, you will notice like a lot of like Oscar kind of fodder films come out like November, December, January. So this film came out in February 1991 in the US, and then it still swept the board the following March in 1992,
That's
which
great.
is unheard of for a film to do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you know how long it was on the circuit? It had to be like forever.
So it would have had like its typical cinema run of like 2, 3 months, and then it wouldn't have been seen again until like people would have thought rewatched it. The Academy would have rewatched it to like give it all the awards it gave. But basically, the Academy are like treated like little babies, so people tend to
Yeah.
put out their Oscar films as late as possible, so it's fresh in everyone's minds. This film did the fucking opposite and was like one of the
Yeah.
first films that came out, but still completely swept the board, which is awesome. And Anthony Hopkins has one of the shortest Best Actor wins of all time. He's only in 21% of the film. I think it accounts for like just under 25 minutes, and he won Best Actor for that. That's like shorter than some supporting actor performances, so that's really cool.
But think about it, it makes sense. One of my theories about why old horror movies are so good is because you don't see the creature, or you see very little of the creature, whatever the subject might be. And I feel it's the same way, because the reason for that being scary or creepy is because your mind fills in a lot of the blanks. Your imagination goes wild, and you're like, oh, I only saw the glint of a claw. What could that possibly be? And so, as film actors, we know that that is something that we can play to. And the fact that he was on screen so very short amount of time is kind of like that. You don't get enough time to get used to him. You don't become familiar with him. As soon as you become familiar with the creature or the bad guy or the entity, they lose some power over you. Because they can haunt your mind without even knowing it. And now that you get to learn about them a little bit more, you're like, ah, no, it's actually not so bad. It's not as bad as I thought. So yeah, I think absolutely Jonathan Demme did the best thing here to use him as sparingly as possible. But also, this was a very grueling role for Anthony Hopkins. He tried his very best never to break character. And that included blinking as very little as possible, which means that his eyes were constantly watering. They were constantly bloodshot and sore. That's why you see him, quote unquote, crying or water coming out of his eyes while he's got his eyes open. It's because his eyes are literally watering. It's gonna be so uncomfortable, but he's like, no, I wanna look like a fucking psychopath, so let me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can imagine that it was very difficult for him to shoot. And also, I think it's kind of difficult to shoot through a plexiglass divide. You know, even if you use a polarizing filter, it's going to be difficult at certain angles. You've got a big camera that you have to cover, blah, 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 blah. I think it was hard, but I'm so happy he did it because he changed his own life. He changed the lives of a lot of people in the real world that love the story. And once again, we don't think that he's a hero, but we certainly think that he is someone with a tragic tale that deserves more than a, oh, he's just a cannibal, you know?
Definitely. Yeah, he definitely brought a ton of depth to this. And yeah, I can imagine anyone else doing it now. In terms of box office, this was made for $19 million and it gained 272.7 million at the box office. And it was one of the highest grossing films of that year.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. In terms of ratings, it's got an 8.6 out of 10 on IMDb. I think it's number 24 on the IMDb top 250.
Ooh.
It's got 95% from both the Rotten Tomatoes critics and audience, and it's got 4.3% on Letterboxd. But I don't care about what they think, I care about what you think next. So, what would you rate The Silence of the Lambs out of 10?
Of 10.
Out of 10, yeah.
I used to have a lecturer that said nobody gets 100%. So I think that that guy is a loser. And I would say I would give it 10 out of 10. The only people I do not recommend watching this film is people who have their heads up their own asses and think that they know what it's about. I would recommend that anybody who likes mystery and intrigue try not just this film, but the entire Hannibal series. Just take a bite. The books are quite short. Start with the books, and it will be a delight. It will be a delight. It's a great nighttime read.
I would have to agree with you. I think it's a 10 out of 10 film as well. I used to be very much like your former lecturer and be very sparing with my 10s, but recently I've just been like, do you know what? Like, if you really, really enjoy it, what is the point in withholding that one point? Like, what is it achieving? Absolutely nothing. Just say you really, really enjoyed it. And I do really, really enjoy
Just
The Silence of the Lambs. So I'm going to give
Marie
it a
Kondo
10.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Marie Kondo it. Does it inspire joy? Does it spark joy? Yes, that's a 10. If this is the
This
kind of film that you're like, I think I would still be watching this in 50 years' time, that's how I feel about it, and I've watched it. Oh, I'm gonna be trying to be honest. I might have actually watched it 50 times. That might not be a lot for some people, but that's actually a whole lot because I've been watching it for so long. But yeah, if I feel like I will still be watching this and I will still be recommending this film to people 50 years down the line, that's a winner for me because I like to watch things from like the 20s. So if those films stood the test of time, this one will too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been so interesting. Like, you know so much about this franchise. I feel like I've learned a lot, and I feel like I really need to get into it a lot more now as well.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad that I could chat to someone about this. That's why I said I didn't want to rush anything because I knew we could still get into it. And I'm glad that you're going to call it quits now because I could talk about this film till the end of time. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to, though. I really enjoyed it.
No worries. Where can my lovely listeners find you online?
I have good and bad news. Good news is you can find me online. The bad news is that I no longer do Sounds Creepy podcast. Life has moved on, and like most young podcasters, I was like, yay, this is going to be me forever. And life caught up, and invariably, people stop after a while. I stopped early because my co-star is very, very important to me, my husband, and he got really involved with stuff. Long story short, I now have a different business that I'm working on, and what we do is we do 3D prints. We actually specialize in glow in the dark or luminous.
Oh, wow.
I should send you some photos. They're really, really beautiful. We make articulated stuff mostly, so articulated unicorns and hammerhead sharks and geckos and slugs and all sorts of things. Like, I know people can't see, but like this kind of guy, and it's fully articulated and it's glow in the dark, and I'm
That's
making these at
so
home.
fucking cool.
It is so cool. I'll send you some pictures. We're doing that. We're also doing AI whispered art. Now, this might be something that people are not familiar with. This is AI made art, but what people don't know is that AI is like a quill or a printing machine or a shovel. It is a tool made to assist people. AI cannot think for itself. It cannot make its own images. There is a person that comes up with a prompt and works over and over again to refine an image, quality tests that changes it afterwards in other editing programs if need be, really works at it and produces an image. Now, I call that whispered art, AI whispered art, because they're kind of like a horse whisperer. People look at AI stuff and they're like, who knows how it works? It's seven fingers on the one hand and it's all bullshit. Or some people go, oh, it's so scary. It's the end of the world. It's none of those things. It's a tool that people can use, and especially artists. Like, people are like, oh, you're not going to buy art anymore. Nobody will invest in it. We will, even more now. But these are tools that artists should use as well. Learn to use them because you are still the wielder. Anyway, long story short, we make 3D prints. We make specialty, limited edition and unique shapes, licensed as well. And then we do ink prints. We do like big posters of AI whispered art. And then we also do like luminous stickers. We do holographic stickers and things like that, specifically travel stickers. So if anybody is looking for any of that stuff, I know it's not film, but you can always hang out with me and chat about it on Sounds Creepy on Twitter, Sounds Creepy Pod at Twitter, on Twitter. And then also my new venture is called Shy Shark Designs. We are on Instagram. Please have a look. And I'd love to see you guys. I'm pretty sure I'm already following you on Instagram.
Amazing. I'm at heightslindsay_ on all social media. You can find the podcast at girlfriends at girlfriend pod on Twitter.
Girlfriend.
I totally blanked there. At girlfriend pod on Twitter and girlfriends underscore podcast on Instagram. I'll be back
We're
in a
all.
fort. Oh, we'll be back in a fortnight. And Sophie's coming back on, who normally does all the Dracula coverage, and we're going to be looking at Hell House LLC, which is Sophie's favorite film. So I'm really looking forward to getting into that.
That's awesome. Do you are you currently watching Dracula right now? Do you guys do like a retrospective?
We did it when it was airing. So all those episodes on season five are out already. If any of you as well listening are just catching up with it now, all of mine and Sophie's reviews are uploaded already, so definitely go back and listen to those. Sophie and I are big fans of drag, and we've been reviewing
So am
Dragula for the
I.
last 3 years, so
Yes,
yeah,
that's
definitely
actually
get
how I
on
found
that.
you guys. The
Oh.
first time I found you was in the drag community, and I was like, I found you guys online, and it was like getting into the podcasting, and I watched some of your lives on Twitch, and then it
Oh,
turns
yeah.
out like you guys really enjoy Drag Race, Dracula, and all that stuff. So unfortunately, I couldn't catch every episode, but I so love putting on back episodes while I'm doing my thing, driving or cleaning the house or doing other projects. And I love listening to your podcast. You guys are heaps of fun.
Thank
I
you.
only I have loyalty to only two, and unfortunately one of my favorite podcasts have stopped 1 or 2 years ago. They were called Pineapple Pizza Podcast. A
All
group of
right.
girls were really funny and really interesting, but they're not on anymore, so it's you now. Thanks for being there. Thanks for being there. When I need to think of something really cool and hear great opinions.
Oh, thank you. Okay, folks, we're gonna close off now. So until next time, stay spooky.